Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Patent Trial and Appeal Board, and Inter Partes Review Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 25, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Kuozo Speed Technologies LLC v. Lee. In 2011, the America Invents Act created an expedited procedure known as Inter Partes Review to provide a cost-effective alternative to litigation for resolving certain challenges to patent validity. The Patent Trial and Appeal Board, contained within the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, hears these disputes rather than a federal district court. When construing patent claims, the board applies a broadest reasonable interpretation standard rather than the plain and ordinary meaning standard typically applied by federal courts. Here, Kuozo Speed Technologies LLC owns a speed limit indicator patent. Garmin International Inc. petitioned the board for inter partes review of claims regarding the patent. The board found that certain claims were unpatentable and denied Kuozo's request to replace these claims with several others. Kuozo appealed the board's decision to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which 1. Held that it lacked authority to review the PTO's decision to institute IPR, and 2. Affirmed the board's final determination, finding no error in its application of the broadest reasonable interpretation standard. There are two questions before the Supreme Court. 1. Whether the Federal Circuit erred in holding that the board may, in IPR proceedings, construe claims according to their broadest reasonable interpretation rather than their plain and ordinary meaning. And 2. Whether the Federal Circuit erred in holding that, even if the board exceeds its statutory authority in instituting an IPR proceeding, the decision to institute the IPR proceeding is judicially unreviewable. To discuss the case, we have Gregory Dolan, who is Assistant Professor of Law and Co-Director, Center for Medicine and Law at University of Baltimore School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Dolan.
In order to understand the dispute at the heart of this case, perhaps some background information on what is a patent is necessary, and I'll try to provide it fairly quickly. A patent, after all, is a legal document that ends with claims where an inventor claims what is his actual invention. And because it's a legal document that actually talks about technical inventions, it is sometimes written in a language that is hard for a layman to understand. That is a feature of all the patents that are generally issued. It's not a bug, precisely because the patent is meant to describe in regular English words a fairly, oftentimes fairly complex technical invention. So it must be both technical in its language as well as sufficiently legal in its language. So it's a somewhat odd document that becomes not easy to interpret. And that is the question that was presented to the Supreme Court in Kuozo versus Lee. How does one interpret a patent? Now, traditionally, when a patent issues and gets litigated, the patent is interpreted by the courts by reference to what a person of ordinary skill in a relevant field of invention, so whether it's pharmaceuticals or computer science or whatever else, what would a reasonable person in the relevant skill of invention understand the claims to mean? And once that is determined, once sort of the court construes these claims, again, because sometimes they're not easy to understand, then you can compare what the claims actually say to any device that is accused of infringing those claims. A few years ago, Congress enacted a bill, now a law, called America Invents Act. America Invents Act recognized that patent litigation has gotten very expensive and is oftentimes used by some unscrupulous parties to extract settlements for claims that may not be very well thought out and may not be valid. There's some debate as to how often it happens and how costly it is, but it certainly happens at least sometimes. And what Congress decided to do is to give the people who's been threatened with lawsuits over alleged infringement of the claims a quicker avenue to challenge the validity of those claims. So instead of going to court and doing the traditional district court litigation with all the costs of discovery, of deposition, of time associated with traditional district court litigation, Congress provided a second avenue to adjudicate at least not so much the infringement, but adjudicate the validity of those claims. And that validity is adjudicated now, should one of the parties so choose, is adjudicated back in the Patent and Trademark Office, the very agency that granted the patent in the first place. And it's adjudicated in very trial-like proceedings, where the party who is challenging the validity of the claims bring in its own experts, bring in its own argument, and a party who owns the claims, bring its own argument and its own experts, and ultimately a panel of administrative patent judges decides up or down whether or not those claims should have issued. The problem that was presented to the Supreme Court stems from how should those administrative patent judges construe those claims. Like I mentioned before, traditionally at the trial court level and on appeal, if the route chosen is the district court litigation, claims are construed by reference to what a person of ordinary skill in a relevant field thinks they mean. But in the patent and trademark office, they are given a broader construction. So instead of construing them by reference to a person of ordinary skill in the art, they're construed by reference to their broadest reasonable construction. So as a result, the claims are potentially read as broader than they actually are. Now, why might that be a problem? One would think that, you know, a broader claim that covers more, is actually a good thing. Well, it turns out not so much. Because a broad claim, while potentially capturing more after arising technology and thus making it easier to prove infringement, it also potentially captures more technology that has arisen beforehand, thus making the claim invalid. So the broader the claim, the more likely it is that it will sweep within its ambit things that came beforehand and therefore would make the claim invalid. It's a sort of fundamental rule of patent law that you cannot claim things that have already been in existence. Now, the broadest reasonable construction is often used, in fact, it's always used, when before the patent issues, when the patent office and the inventor essentially negotiate over the scope of the claim. They do a back and forth, very much like a law professor and a student go back and forth during the Socratic method to make sure to nail down the precise scope of the argument, precise scope of the invention. But once the claim issues, it sort of becomes kind of set in stone. And at that point, the courts apply the person of ordinary skill construction, which is narrower in scope, making it somewhat more difficult to prove infringement, but making it easier to sustain the validity of the claim. After Congress created the America Invents Act, what the Patent and Trademark Office decided to do is they said that even in these post-issuance quasi-litigation proceedings, even though the claim has issued, even though it may very well even been litigated before and sustained on appeal, the Patent Office will go back to the broadest reasonable construction, thus making it easier to invalidate the claims. And the reason the Patent Office provided was that that's kind of how they always done it within the Patent Office, and it doesn't matter whether the previous proceedings were examination, where it's just a negotiation, where a patentee or applicant in the Patent Office could go back and forth, amend the claim as necessary, or this new thing of litigation proceedings. Patent Office basically said this is how we've always done it, and there was no reason to deviate now. And that is the issue that the Supreme Court granted certiorari on. Whether or not the Patent Office was correct in taking this different claim construction standard, the standard that was up until now used only in examination proceedings, where there's a back and forth between a patent and trademark office as well as the patentee or the applicant, and importing that standard to a trial-like proceedings where there is not such back and forth, where you kind of a claim sort of either rise or fall. The Federal Circuit from which appeal was taken said that that's perfectly fine, although it split on that issue 6-5 in the denial of petition for rehearing en banc. And it is from the question and answer session and from the oral argument session in the Supreme Court, it was not particularly clear which way the court was leaning. There were concerns on both sides. For example, Chief Justice Roberts has asked several tough questions of the government defending patent office practice, basically being concerned that the Congress's intent of streamlining litigation proceedings, of making it easier, may very well be undermined by having two different standards apply in district court and in this administrative litigation. While on the other hand, Justice Breyer expressed concern that unless this sort of broader standard of interpretation continues to be upheld, making it easier to invalidate claims, it will be Congress's purpose in protecting people from unscrupulous patent litigation will also not be carried into being. There was some also active question from Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg, but ultimately I think all justices were somewhat unsure as to which of those two concerns should predominate and whether or not Patent Office should get any deference, being an administrative agency, in deciding how to run its affairs. So there are certainly very good arguments, I suppose, for either side, and I think both attorneys did quite well arguing their case and explaining why one standard or another was appropriate. And I don't think, given sort of the tone of questioning, it was particularly clear as to which way the justices were leaning. To the extent there's any indication of the outcome, and I don't know that it is, but I believe there were more Amici supporting the petitioner, supporting the challengers to this patent office standard, and they were supporting the government. And in the interest of full disclosure, I myself filed an amicus brief on the petitioner's side. One other point that I want to quickly raise is that the case was actually, there was another question granted by the Supreme Court, and although at least an oral argument, parties focused on it very, very briefly. There was only perhaps a minute or two from either side addressing this issue. But the issue basically was whether or not certain patent office procedures are even subject to appeal. So the way these new post-issuance proceedings happen is a petition is brought to the patent office, and at the first step, the patent office decides whether or not to even proceed with the petition, and only at the second step do they decide whether or not to uphold or invalidate the claims. And so this, the second question brought to the Supreme Court is whether that initial preliminary step of deciding whether or not to proceed is or is not subject to appeal. Again, this was not an issue that was either the parties or the courts particularly focused on during oral argument, so that is even less clear as to how the courts will come out. But that is sort of another thing to look for. Once again, the Federal Circuit said that that issue is, in fact, not appealable. Some were tracking the language of the statute, but the court either did not seem particularly interested in it or just seemed more interested in the issue that I first discussed. So we expect a decision by late June, perhaps early July, and for now it's not exactly clear how the court will go, and I would not be surprised either at a unanimous decision or at a fairly fractured one as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.